some of the deepest mysteries surround the question of the Arava. You're all aware, I'm sure, that the custom tomorrow morning is that we, apart from the mitzvah of Lulav and Esrog, that we use the rest of Sukkos, there's a Kabbalistic custom that comes down from the prophets to beat Arava's willow branches, beat them to destruction on the ground. If you read sources that talk about it, they'll tell you that we can't understand what it means, which means we're certainly not going to understand what it means this evening, and I certainly don't understand what it means. But the point is that we understand that some very deep things are happening connected to this mitzvah. The sources that reveal something talk about the following idea. We know that the symbolism of the minim that we take on Sukkos, each of the four has a different symbolism attached to it. We know that in Torah, symbolic things are not just sentimental connections. They have an intrinsic connection. On the contrary, we know that when we do an action, it's moving energies in the higher worlds that are changing the dispensation of what comes down to the world. It's not sentimental or romantic or token at all. Now, what is this Arava that we single out from the rest of the minim and we use tomorrow morning? So there's a marvelous idea that goes something like this. It's common knowledge, most people know, that if you trace the connection, the symbolism, the connection of the minim, so you have an Esrog, which is, let's say, the highest, some places are connected to Avram Avinu, it's that which has everything. It has taste and smell, meaning it has Torah and Maasim. Torah, the knowledge dimension, the higher dimension, and the action dimension, both combined. You have the Lulav, which has a taste, palm, which has only fruit. You have the Hadassim, which has the smell, but not the fruit. And Arovas has nothing. Yet. Arovas is really to be kosher, Arovas, there's halachas about the other species, how they have to be kosher. Arovas, virtually anything is kosher. If you have a stick of Lulav, stick of willow with more or less two leaves attached, it's halfway recognizable, pretty much kosher. It doesn't really need much. It's really the thing that has very little attached to it. And that it really symbolizes the people, in the element of the Jewish people who have nothing, those who have neither Torah or mitzvahs. Now that's very relevant to our generation, because we're dealing with a generation where for the first time in history, the vast majority of the Jewish people are completely clueless. Completely clueless about the fact that they're Jewish altogether. What that means, they have no connection to that. That's a shocking fact that throughout Jewish history, until 100 years ago, certainly until 150 years ago, we were part of a nation where the depth to which we were imbued with what it meant to be Jewish was so strong that people were prepared to be tortured to death, right? Protracted torture, even children, without thinking of relinquishing their connection to Yiddishkeit. No question about it. It's known that the Catholic Church killed millions of Jews, some say more than the Germans killed, and most of them were killed by being tortured to death. The reason was that they wanted to persuade them to convert to Christianity. It's not just that they were sadistic. They wanted to persuade them to convert. That was the point of the exercise. And millions of our people throughout the centuries went through torture individually, en masse, women, little children, whole communities, right? Chose death and chose torture, which may be worse than death, rather than choose some, even pretend to accept somebody else's religion. Even pretend. For the first time in the history of the Jewish people, we've reached a situation where the majority of the Jewish people, not just a handful here and there, but the majority of the Jewish people have already chosen something different. And without pressure, without torture. As an aside, what's worth thinking about at a time like this, which is Sukkos, which is a time when the whole question of Jewish identity as compared to non-Jewish identity, Sukkos is a time, trying to understand this and bring it out from the idea of the Arava, is a time when the distinction between the Jewish people, even the lowliest, even the representative of the Jewish people who knows and has the least, is distinguished from the non-Jews in the most powerful way. Sukkos is the time that the non-Jews have a connection to. The sacrifices on Sukkos, the korbanos, are made for the non-Jewish nations. It's a time that they have some connection to a sukkah, not to the eighth day. The eighth day is a time when we privately, along with Hashem, but the 7 days are certainly connected to, and it's It's because they're connected to it that we understand our relationship with them and our distinction from them. Some have said that sukkah says the yom tov of shaloya sami goy. That's what it is. That's what the sukkah is. So as an aside, it's worth remembering on this yom tov that the majority of the Jewish people, who are few in number, the numbers of the Jewish people really haven't increased in centuries, out of those Jewish people out there on whom the future of the world depends, because it says, "Imloy brisi yoman v'layla, chukah shemayim v'aretz leisamti," if it would not be for Torah that the Jewish people are carrying through the world, then the world would not exist. And the Gaon says in Nefesh HaChaim, Nefesh HaChaim brings down at least twice that if there'd be a moment of no Torah learning in the world would disappear. If there'd be a second during which no one was learning Torah, the world would literally disappear, go back to its primordial state. So the universe, the existence of the universe, depends on Torah being learned by the Jewish people. Huh? And that cosmic structure depends on whom? On the Jewish people, who are not that many in number. And how many of the Jewish people are doing that job right now? It's a remarkably small percentage of people are doing it. And of those who think they're doing it, those who think they're connected to Torah, in case you think we're talking about other people, those who think they're connected to Torah, it's a pitiful handful of us who actually know what we're talking about. And actually learning in some way that raises itself beyond the very, very mediocre. Which means if you want to take it seriously, that on your narrow shoulders, on our narrow shoulders, quite literally, devolves a measurable share of the existence of the universe. Quite literally, it's not, rhetorical hyperbole. It literally means that. You could count on a few hands the numbers of the Jewish people who seriously involved in Torah learning, for its own sake, what it really means to learn Torah. And on that depends the existence of the Jewish people and the existence of the entire universe. So if you want to work out your proportion, the burden that you carry, the percentage share that you carry of the existence of the universe right now, it's a finite proportion. It took us the time to think about this. So we have the following idea, that this Arava that represents the concept of someone who's Jewish but has nothing of Judaism, that means he knows nothing and he has no Jewish practice. He's connected by virtue of the fact that he's Jewish. He's somehow connected. Some say it means connected in by virtue of the fact that he belongs to a community. That means B'Shem Yisrael Yuchone or Torah. That means he's called Jewish. That means he knows he's called Jewish. He knows he's called Jewish, which you should know. There are many Jews in the world today, but even that doesn't apply. We had a person come through Osamach a couple of years ago who told us that he came there because his father, when his father was dying, he told him he was Jewish. As he sat with his father while his father died, he told him that he thinks this is the appropriate time to tell him that actually you're Jewish. He came to Osamach to find out what that meant. Not everybody knows. But if they know they're called Jewish, and it says they haven't separated themselves from the Jewish community, doesn't mean they've really connected themselves, but they haven't separated. They belong to a shul. They go three times a year. Once a year, they pay dues, and they regard themselves as a member of that shul. Maybe that's enough. One step before intermarriage, maybe. So such a person, that's the Arava really. That's the Arava. Maybe even less than that. That's a person who has nothing. But he's bonded in there with the Jewish people. We can't get rid of him. We don't want to get rid of him. We can't get rid of him. He can't get rid of us. As Rav Asim, as Asal used to say, the tragedy of those people is that they don't have to pay the price for being Jewish. The torture that's meted out to people who try to escape is the same as those who don't. 50 years ago, somebody who was one quarter, the fourth generation, descended from a Jew someplace, was tortured or killed in the same way as those who were fully aware of what it meant. So he used to say, if you're going to pay the price, you might as well have the merchandise. The tragedy of those people, and they have to pay the price anyway. You might as well have the goods. And that's the tragedy of this generation, they're paying the price, and they'll have to pay the price, and not have the goods. But that's the kind of person we're talking about. What it means to beat it on the floor, that's another story. So what is this personality? What is this personality of a Jew who doesn't know? I mean, it's very questionable how many of us can say we're really out of that category. So there's sugyas in the Gemara that talk about the reality of this person who's called an Amaret. This person who doesn't know anything. He's Jewish, but he doesn't know. And there's a remarkable thing, an unbelievably inspiring thing that we have to know. And this really is a message for those of us who have very little background, especially people who come to yeshiva like this, where they start off with very little, hardly even knew they were Jewish, and they feel they're floundering, they have really no connection, they don't understand what's going on. There's such a weak start in life in these matters. So there's some midrashim and gemaras that talk about the fact that such a person has got a stronger connection to Yiddishkeit than somebody who has much of it. A remarkable paradox. Let's see if we can try and understand this. So The Gemara says, the Medrash says that once of Yanai, remarkable story, Yanai was walking along the road, and he met an individual who was hungry, man, walking along the street, asked him for some food. So Yanai shared his bread with him, and while the man was eating his food, if Yanai asked him some questions in Torah, he tested him in Chumash, he found he knew nothing, Mishnah knew nothing, Gemara knew nothing, Halacha, the man knew nothing at all. So when it came to when the man had finished eating and he knew nothing of Torah, so Yanai was so disgusted, and he felt so strongly about it, that the way he dealt with this Amoraites was, the man couldn't even bench for the bread that he did. So Yanai said, say after me the following words. He wanted as if to say, I'll show you'll say the appropriate after bracha for this food by saying the words after me. And the words were, he said, say the following words, Achal, Kalba, Pita, de Yanai. A dog has eaten the bread of Yanai. That's what he made him say. The man understood, of course. He understood what he'd been forced to say, what he made to say. And he attacked him, Yanai. He attacked him. And in this thrashing that he gave this great sage, during this thrashing he said to him, you're a thief. This Amoraites, who knew not enough to bench even for the bread that he'd eaten in that generation, can you imagine what that meant? When every Jew knew that when he was three, this man knew nothing. He accused Rabbeinu of being a thief. So Rabbeinu said, what did I steal? He said, Yerusosi Gabach. It means, my inheritance is by you. You've stolen my inheritance. So Rabbeinu said, what do you mean? So the man said, because once I remember, this was the entire connection to Judaism, once I remember walking past the cheder, and through the window, I heard one verse. I heard the Rebbe teaching the little kids, little children, and the Rebbe said, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Mirosha kilas Yaakov. That's what I heard him say. I heard him say, that Torah tziva lanu Moshe, that Moshe taught us Torah, Mirosha, it is the inheritance of the people of Yaakov. Mirosha kilas Yaakov, Omar, he said it's the inheritance of the people of Jacob, when he did not say, V'loi Omar Mirosha di Yanai. He didn't say it's Yanai's inheritance. He said, in other words, and Yanai was terribly upset. He begged forgiveness and he went to extremes to try and gain the man's forgiveness. But what comes out of this is that what he learned, what he was taught, this great sage of Israel was taught by an individual who knew nothing, who was worthy of being called a dog by a man. You know that? That means one of the great sages of Israel found it appropriate to call another Jew a dog. That means his resemblance to the human form was so slight that the name dog is appropriate. We're not talking about people who gave vent to their emotions. We're talking about a perfectly accurate, considered judgment when he called him a dog, and he made him call himself a dog. You understand the insult? That is so little recognizable in Jewish terms that it was even questionable if there was a human resemblance. But he learned from this man and knew nothing. He learned something that he never knew before. He learned that it's inheritance of the Jewish people and not his. That means he learned that even a person who has nothing, this arova, this miserable arova of the Jewish people who has nothing, but he has an inheritance, which means he has an intimate, inalienable connection to Torah that even a great sage doesn't have. It's a remarkable thing. Remarkable thing. It means that a person who's got no background is more sensitive in some ways. You know, it's a common statement about Tshuva Yeshiva, that a person is frum from birth, so that he has an advantage over the Baal Tshuva, and the Baal Tshuva has an advantage over him. The person who's brought up frum has an advantage, he knows a lot. But his disadvantage is he's often not enthusiastic about it. You know, he grew up with it, he takes it for granted. The Baal Tshuva, he knows very little, he's awkward and he gets the words wrong and he says them backwards and he gets confused, but he's very enthusiastic about it. I mean, that's well known. There was a bris not so long ago in Yerushalayim, and a famous moel was doing the bris, and while he was busy, the father of the child made his three brochas, and the moel noticed that the brochas had more intensity than usual. So while he was busy, he said, it must be a Baal Tshuva. And the father, the Sunday, said, yes, I'm the grandfather, you're right, you know. The Baal Tshuva, could you please make it fast? I'm not feeling too good. But anyway, the point is that he knew from the fact that the brocha was intense that the person was a Baal Tshuva. It's a remarkable thing. There's more intensity. But we see tonight that it goes much deeper than that. And there are many examples. The Gemara says, it says that certain phase in Jewish history, a disaster happened because the people, destruction of the temple time, because they never made a brocha on Torah. Shlo berchu b'Torah b'tchila. Means they never made the correct brocha on learning Torah. And one explanation is that it means that the people who were involved in learning Torah made a bracha. They never made a bracha with the right intensity. That means they were so involved in Torah from such a young age that they took it for granted in a certain way. But it's the Jews who have no background that don't take it for granted. It's a remarkable thing. It means there's a pride in being that arava. It's a remarkable thing. That Arava that has nothing, but he has an intimate connection to the Jewish people in a way that people with more background don't have. It's a very inspiring message for people who have little background. It goes even further than that. There's one place where it says, another Midrash says that once an Amaretz came up to one of the Tanoim, Amaroim, I think, and said to him, I'll tell you a good vort, I'll tell you a beautiful Dvar Torah, if you repeat it in my name. So the Amaretz said, let's hear. So he told him the following thing. It says that that the gifts that Yaakov gave to Esav, you remember the sheep and the camels and the gifts that he sent to Esav, right? That those went to Esav's portion in the world, that when the Mashiach comes, those things will be given back to us. Why? Because it says, Malchai Tarshish Ve'im, I think it says, Mincha Yoshivu, they'll give back the gift. So this Amaretz made a diuk. It says, Mincha Yoshivu, it doesn't say, Mincha Yitnu, it doesn't say they'll give, it says they'll return. They'll return a gift. That means when the Mashiach comes, the non-Jews will approach him, and they'll give him a gift. But the word chosen there is not that they'll come and give the Mashiach a gift, they'll return him a gift. Return means something that he had originally and was given away. What is that? What Yaakov gave to Esav. In other words, you understand, very beautiful idea. I once heard my Rebbe say that the gifts that he gave were the ancillary portions of Torah. In other words, he gave Esav the scientific and technological aspects of wisdom that are needed for Torah. And that's why the secular world, the world of Edom, has great expertise in those fields. But actually, they are ancillary portions of Torah that are needed within Torah. Certain astronomical calculations, certain other kinds of scientific wisdom. They'll be given back to us. Right now, they're not in our control. The heart of Torah is. Those ancillary ripples are not. They'll be given back. But what you hear about this is, and he repeated it in Amaretz's name. Yes? That means, I think it was Rabushia, Tana. Borderline Tana, Moira. Rabushia, when he heard this beautiful vote from this Amaretz, he went and repeated it in public in the name of the Amaretz. I mean, that's remarkable. That's Amar Rabushia, Amar Amaretz. No, that's what it comes out. That he said it in the name of a person and knew nothing. But what's beautiful is you hear that the Jew that put into Jewish tradition a statement that's quoted by Tanoim, Amoraim, is a Jew who could grasp that nothing will go lost from Torah. A remarkable thing. That statement's not credited, its origin is not credited to a great Tana of the Gemara. That's credited to an Amaretz who knew nothing, was the one who put into the Jewish people the awareness that even the ancillary parts of Torah will not be lost, they'll be returned. Remarkable thing. Certain power and depth in that. Now let's see if we can go a drop further than this. Where does this power lie? This power at the roots of a Jewish neshama that connects it up, even though the person himself is almost unaware that he has this connection, and yet there's this very strong wellspring in the neshama that can do this. What is this koyach of the arava? What is it? Where is it? Now, the answer is that there's a certain part of consciousness that's deeper than the level of explicit consciousness. This is a very difficult discussion, and we'll have to stay tightly together now. And this subject is probably the most important thing you'll ever hear. There's no more important aspect of consciousness than this, and it's exactly what's lacking in this generation. That's what we all lack most potently. And that is the dimension of our consciousness that can know things deeper than the level of the explicit or the scientific or the measurable. That's where Emunah lies. That's where Emunah is. Emunah is only in that depth of the neshama. That's deeper than the tangible, the mechanical, the mathematical. It's the only place where Emunah is. And it's the only place where real inner self-knowledge and real knowledge is. And of course, that's what this generation lacks. All we prepare to credit in this generation is that which you can measure and test in the lab and deal with scientifically. But that which is deeper than that, of course, we don't have any skill in. And of course, that's why this generation is purely mechanical, mechanistic. It reduces man to an animal. And if you want to reach a level of emunah, of knowing something deeper than that, you have to do it with a special tool. The tool is not the scientific Western technical. If you use those tools, you will definitely end up thinking that the man's a gorilla. There's no question about it. You need a deeper tool. And because it's deeper than the technical, than the finite, than the measurable, the problem is that there aren't any words for it. And that's why this is a very exhausting discussion. But let's see if we can just touch on it as a beginning this evening. First of all, before we try to examine it as best we can in some way, let's deal maybe with one or two applications of this thing. Let me try and give you one or two examples. We're talking here about Das, about an inner wisdom that's called Das. It's the kli, the vessel of Emunah. You know, the sukkah is called Tzela de Mehem Nusa. It's called the shadow of Emunah. That's what the Zohar, the Kabbalistic writings talk, that's what they call the sukkah. The sukkah is a place where Emunah is tangible. Actually, it says that the light that shines in the sukkah is the light that's on the outside, the light that surrounds the world that doesn't have a measurable limit. Two kinds of light, one fits inside, one fits outside. Very deep ideas. But the light that shines in sukkah is so deep. I once heard from a man who told me, very interesting thing, that there are certain people who don't sleep in the sukkah. You know that? There's a big argument about it. You know, look, there's certain people who don't sleep in the sukkah. But where that tradition arose was probably from a certain Rebbe who was unable to sleep in the sukkah. I'm not advertising here for any sect, you understand? I'm not keeping this way above the partisan level. But the point is that the light that shines in the sukkah is so powerful that there was a person who's conscious of it, couldn't bring himself to sleep. He sat there, his eyes wouldn't close. But Emunah can only be grasped. You want to have some feeling for it, or as the mystics would say, knowledge of it. It's only a deeper knowledge. It cannot be done with explicit tangible. And therefore, the only way we can talk about it is to talk around it. We can't actually describe it directly. But we can talk about some applications of it. Let's talk about this Arova. Let's talk about an Arova application, just to give us some feel for it. One of the applications of Das, inner wisdom, listen well, is the knowledge that you're Jewish. Again. Let's examine this carefully. Let's take it at rock bottom. What does this Arova person know? Simply that he's Jewish. That he's got the name Jew and he's connected to the Jewish people. That's all he knows. How does he know that? Let's understand this carefully. Do you know that you're Jewish because you were told sociologically, intellectually, or is it deeper than that? If it's correctly known, it's known in your bloodstream. It's known at a level much deeper than can ever be intellectual. It's got nothing to do with having been told it when you were born. That might be necessary as well. But there's a knowledge of what it means. There's a feeling of the distinction between a Jew and a Goy, a Jew and a non-Jew. There's a feeling of that distinction that is so intense with the person who has it, that it's way beyond the element of having been told. You find that there are many people who were brought up in a way in homes where they were told by their parents, nothing disrespectful was ever said about non-Jews. And yet these Jews have the most intense feeling of the difference between them and non-Jews. Where does that come from? What is that exactly? The tragedy of this discussion, of course, is that we witness the transition. We live in a generation where that awareness is rapidly fading. It will be brought back to us either because we reawaken it ourselves or we'll be forced into it through shock tactics, unfortunately. But right now we're losing it. A remarkable example of this, one of the most powerful examples I ever heard, was I once heard a great man say that he was once speaking to a certain leader of the previous generation. He didn't say the name, so I don't want to say, I'm certain I know who it was, but generally acknowledged one of the great leaders of the previous generation who lived until the 1960s. And this great man was saying, it's a remarkable thing, this great man said the following words. He said that once, I'm quoting now, once a young man came and asked me, listen to this conversation, remarkable thing. Once a young man came and asked me how it was possible for Jews of this generation, he meant this, the period from 1900, 1915, 1917 through to the 1970s, that block of time, how it was possible for Jews of that generation to be swept away by a philosophy that was so ridiculous. He was talking, of course, about socialism and communism, that so much of the Jewish world was swept away by that the leaders of that movement were Jewish. It swept people out of the yeshivas, People who had a Torah background were swept away. It's a remarkable, an unbelievable thing. I heard only this evening from a Rosh Yeshiva. I heard this from a well-known Rosh Yeshiva earlier this evening. He said to me that he once heard personally from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. I mean, had I not heard it from this person, I would have almost impossible. He said Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky once, when he was in Eretz Yisrael, he personally told him the following matter, that when he was 15, he and Rav Aaron Kotler and another individual, I'm not sure who it was, the third one, but certainly the two of them and a third, we're talking about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rav Aaron Kotler, the two of them were about to join the Bundes. Yes? They were 15 and they were going to join the Bundes. So the Altar of Slobodka gave them 5 rubles a month that they should stay in the yeshiva, and for that reason they stayed. Yeah, that's what he said? And I said, okay. We're talking about 15-year-olds. In that 15-year-olds, when Rav Yaakov was young, we're talking about the beginning of the century, the beginning of that, and that means somebody with 15 years of his degree of Torah background. You know what 15 years old was in those days? It was more Torah than most of us ever achieve in our lifetimes. Rav Chaim Moiser, when he was 13, alright, he was an unusual individual, but I mean, when Rav Chaim Moiser was 13, for his bar mitzvah drosha, he got up and told him that he hadn't had time to prepare because he was too busy learning, but if they wanted to start him anywhere in the Nesivos HaMishpat, yes? Or Tabas HaKreshen, so they could start him off and he carried on. For 3 hours they started him off and he carried on. Yeah, he was 13. So now, to know the Nesivos, you have to know the Ketzos. To know the Ketzos, you have to know the Shulchan Aruch. To know Shulchan Aruch, you have to know the Gemara. Then for that, you have to know the Mishnah. Cold, absolutely. And he was 13. So when did he start? When he was 6? 7? 8? So in 6 years, let's say, you achieved that. So now, how long have you been learning? How many of us will get there in the next 6 or 7 years with all our maturity and wisdom? So 15, but understand that the draw of this Yetzer must have been amazing. If Rabbi Yaakov could say that, that at age 15, with that level of maturity, he was seriously about to do this. And the only way the altar could keep him in the yeshiva wasn't through argumentation. The altar himself, the only way could keep him was by paying them 5 rubles a week or a month to stay in yeshiva, to understand what the Yetzer was. So that's what this young man asked. How was there such a Yetzer? How did they get swept away by something so ridiculous? We've seen it collapse. For us, it's easy. We've seen how stupid it is. But in those days, when it was the upsurge, where it held sway in the world, as Rav Wasserman used to say, it was such a stupid philosophy. It denies the natural motivations of people. It denies the individuality. It denies such important things. It's such a stupid philosophy. So silly. And the world is a current of enthusiasm that took people away from centuries of Torah that had proved itself. What made them lose their heads in that way? So this great man said like this. I said to this young man who asked me, listen to this incredible idea. This fascinating Torah which I'm sharing with you. Not all of that's relevant to the Arava yet, but we'll get there. He said like this. I said to him that the answer is as follows. There's a Gemara that says, Achas b'shivim shana, once every 70 years, Oile koichat, a star rises, shemate es asaponim. That means, a star, incredible idea. A star rises, that's out of place. The Kodesh Baruch Hu puts a star into the astronomical system, that's out of place. Mate es asaponim means it misleads the ship's captains, or what you'd call today the navigators, and they steer by that star, it's out of sync with where it should be, they get confused, they follow that star, and they go wrong. And every 70 years, what he explained was 70 years really means every generation has its own Nisoyon, that's what it means every 70 years is a normal lifespan. It means that once every 70 years, once every lifespan, every generation is tested by a star, star meaning a guiding light, an ideal, an ideology, that's a guiding light of that generation, that's out of sync, it's wrong, it's purely a Nisoyon from Hashem. Alright, you should realize that it's only one star. What about following the rest? What about knowing the Gemara that says that there'll be a Nisoyon? Their way is out of it. It's not a completely unavoidable Nisoyon, but nevertheless, it says clearly Hashem does not, it's not your own misperception. HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes a star and he puts it out of place. But that's a clear Nisoyon. Clear. So that's what happened. This star was put out of place, and that means in a way that we could never understand, because it's not our star. Not our misguided, misplaced star in this generation. To us it looks like the most plastic and pathetic and ridiculous thing. But in their day it was a Yetzer so strong it was almost irresistible. That was the explanation. Now, here comes the part of the story that we need. So this Talmid Chacham, who was listening to this great man say this, at that point in the story, the man I heard it from, he said, at that point I said to him, Rebbe, what is the star that's misleading our generation? That means now, you and me. And he said, I think it is the blurring of the distinction between Jew and non-Jew. You hear that? That means, listen to what that means. Think about that for a second. It means that the distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew is so clear, that it's so posh, it's so clear, it's so blindingly clear that it swirls in your bloodstream unavoidably. That's a completely natural part of Jewish consciousness. There's a star that's misguided in this generation that's wrenched it out of Jewish consciousness to the extent that's completely illogical, doesn't make any sense. You can't grapple with it. If you try to argue with somebody who's holding there, there's no way to communicate. Because it's an unbelievable Yetzer that... Remarkable thing. You know, after I heard that, I suddenly thought of a case that had illustrated it to me. I happened to study one point with a certain young lady who came from a home. I used to visit that home. And in that house, there was nothing Jewish at all. The two girls were brought up in that home, this girl and her older sister. And in that home, it was remarkable for a South African Jewish family that there was so little of Jewish content. There were no candlesticks in the house, there was no mezuzah, they never saw a siddur. There was no vestige of anything Jewish at all. And not only that, but they were only a couple of minutes walk from a major Jewish day school, and the girls were sent a great distance to a non-Jewish public school, right? Instead of being sent to the Jewish day school, which is right there. It's unusual for South Africans. That means explicitly giving them no Jewish content at all. Okay? What happened? The older daughter married a non-Jew, right? And the father disowned her. He just, at the time that the sister told me the story, she had a child who was 2 years old that the grandfather had never seen. Right? He disowned her to the extent that he never saw her again, and he never saw his grandchild because she married a non-Jew. Now, what's going on? This family gave the children absolutely nothing. Nothing Jewish at all. The girl marries a non-Jew and the father... what's going on? But I'll tell you what's going on. What's going on is that this father, to him the concept of the difference between... He was from that generation. The difference between Jew and non-Jew got nothing to do with Jewish input and education and telling your daughters. It's got nothing to do with that. It flows in your bloodstream that it's absolutely so clear that the difference is tangible. You could smell it. You could feel, you could smell, you could see the difference between a Jew. To marry a non-Jew is unfathomable, it's unthinkable. It's so unthinkable that he didn't think he had to tell his daughter. But she, who grows up in a generation where the stars shifted, it's out of sync, she thinks the father's psychotic. She thinks the man's psychotic. He taught me nothing about being Jewish. She can't see the difference between a Jew and a non. She can't smell it. She can't see it. There's no way they can communicate on that subject. This is another way of saying, by the way, that our das, that means our inner healthy consciousness that knows things deeper than words can ever say, that's going. That's what we're saying here. The way you know you're Jewish in that way, that you know you can't marry a non-Jew. That's not because your parents told you so. Or because you read books about what the non-Jews have done to us. That's not the reason. The reason is that there's a thing called das. There's a dimension of your mind that grasps it in such a real way that it's more real than many other things. But we're witnessing the transition to a generation where the das is collapsing. You need proof. I mean, has there ever been a generation in the history of the world where people didn't even know whether they were human? This is a generation, for the first time in the history of the world, where there's a major doubt about whether we're human or animal. And I would say today it's not even a doubt, it's a foregone conclusion today. I mean, the Western world is based on the premise that you're an accidental version of an amoeba. That's what, you're once a gorilla, or whatever, and now you're a more attractive version of a gorilla. Less attractive, I don't know. Had such an idea been suggested 100, 150, 200 years ago, any other generation in the world's history, had it ever been suggested that a person was an animal, it would have been the most ridiculously unthinkable statement, right? Not because the facts don't fit together, but because there's an inner consciousness of what it means to be human. That's got nothing to do with education. Victor Miller always puts it in the sharpest way. The way he puts it, in the way that only he can. The way he illustrates it in one short, beautiful maaser, he tells about the student from Cornell University, which is near Harlem. Cornell. Huh? Columbia. Wherever it was, I don't know, someplace near Harlem. He calls up the police and he says, "You better come quickly because they've got a man tied down to the table who's alive and they're busy cutting him up alive." So the police scream down to this address, which turns out to be this anatomy dissection thing, and they find a gorilla, likely anesthetized gorilla, taped down to the table, and the anatomy students are busy dissecting this animal. So the police come in and they say, "I thought you said there was a man being hacked to pieces here." So the student says, "Yes, he's my first cousin." No? And he says to the policeman, it's only a little bit of time that separates us, you know, in the scheme of things, and we're closely related. And therefore, if you can do this to him, what's to stop you doing it? If it's legal and moral to be able to do this to this animal because he's too dumb to protest, what's the problem with taking some defenseless human being and doing it to him? And on the other hand, if it's immoral and wrong to do it to a human, then what gives you the right to do it to this? So the professor, you understand, the cop, you know, the cop spits on the floor and he walks out. He has no problem because a cop's a cop. He knows a man's a man, a monkey's a monkey. It's posh, he doesn't have a problem. But the professor of anatomy got to scratch his head because, you know, it's a serious problem for him. You understand? In other words, so what does it boil down to? It boils down to the fact that the most basic things that a person has to know, the fact that you're a human being. Of course, just like we don't know we're Jewish anymore, so the secular world doesn't know it's human. It's always like that. It's always like that. We have to have a relationship to being what's called Adam, and they have to be called what's called Ha-Adam, whatever it is. They have to be human and we have to be Yidden.
We don't know we that, and they don't know that either.
This faculty of das needs a whole discussion in its own right. But it's a faculty in which a person knows things because he knows them. It's got nothing to do with being taught. It's got nothing to do with being working it out intellectually. It's a level that has to seep into you. You know, the Gemara says, the dabe kulabe. The person who has this, meaning das, has everything. The lo dabe, maabe. A person who doesn't have das, what does he have? The Gemara says he has nothing at all. Do you know what the Gemara says in one place? It says, Misha en bodea. Listen to the statement. Misha en bodea, a person who doesn't have das, asur le rachem olav. You hear that? It's forbidden to have mercy on such a person. You hear that? Before you say it, it's forbidden because it'll be bad for him. That means if you'll help such an individual, if you'll have, you will show kindness to such an individual, you'll misuse it. It's like giving a drug addict money. Not that you don't want to show him kindness, but he'll buy more drugs. So if you take a person who doesn't have das, everything you'll give will be misused. Because das is the rock bottom stratum of the personality that where things make sense. It's the basis of common sense. It's the knowledge that you're human. It's the knowledge that you're Jewish. It's the knowledge that there's right and wrong. It's the knowledge that you exist. All those things have got nothing to do with proofs, with intellectualizations. The basis of the das, the basis of the das, if a person wants to try and develop it, this must be the hardest thing in the world to develop. How do you develop it? How do you start getting a knowledge of things that you know because you know them, without being taught them? How do you know that? You woke up, yes, you inhabited some campus someplace where you thought that marrying a non-Jew was fine because you couldn't see the difference. Now you want to seep into your bloodstream. Yes, you want that star to shift. You want it to seep into your bloodstream that that's not true. How do you do that? The fact is it happens. That miracle happens. People come to a place like this and it happens to them. I think Rav Wasserman would have said that Torah does it. Torah is the Das. Torah is a shining in of the Das. And if you make yourself a vessel for it, if you make yourself a vessel for it, so then it shines in. The way to prevent yourself becoming a vessel is to cling to externality so strongly that common sense never touches sides with you. Which, of course, is exactly the Bolshevik problem. It's the problem of getting so connected to externality. Right? If you want to judge the superficiality of a Bolshevik, you can look at the length of his pious. The longer, the more suspect. That's usually the way it goes. The more superficial, external show, often, the more suspect the internality. It's not an absolute rule. And sometimes there's a need to do it, like the Rambam says, to bend a tree over to an extreme degree so that it comes back to the middle. There are reasons, there are situations, there are exceptions. But the classic Bolshevik error is getting hooked up to externality so powerfully that there's no hope of ever developing anything internal. The first thing you have to do is be mevatel all that external show. You need a Rebbe. You need a Rebbe who's prepared to beat it into you and for you to allow it to be beaten into you. You need a Rebbe that's prepared to insult you, that you're prepared to take insults from meaningfully. Rav David Weiss always used to, he told us that the trouble is that when you have a Rebbe who's prepared to tell you, you're usually unable to hear it. He used to tell us that once when he was learning with Rav Volbi when he was young, must have been I guess 20, he once went to Rav Volbi and he said, I want you, yes, in a trepidation, he went to the great man and he said, I would like to come and sit with you once a month, I'm begging you, as my Rebbe, I would like to sit with you once a month, you should give me Musa. Tell me what's wrong with me. I'm asking you, I'll come and sit here once a month, the Rebbe will tell me what's wrong with me, and that's how I'll build myself. So Rav Volbi said to me, you don't want me to tell you what's wrong with me, with you. That's not what you want at all. You're just so full of pride. All you want is to be able to say that you sat with Rosh Hashiva. That's all you want. You want to be able to go and tell your friends that once a month you sit with Rosh Hashiva and he gives you Musa. That's all you want. You don't want to prove yourself. He was so ashamed. He said he was so embarrassed that he couldn't face him for weeks. He couldn't face him for weeks. For months he used to sneak in every corridor until one day he was sneaking through some corridor and Rav Volbi was walking up that corridor and he bumped into him. So Rav Volbi said to him, why haven't you been coming for the Musa that you asked for? So he said, because the Rebbe told me that I don't want Musa. The Rebbe told me. He said, but I was just doing what you asked me. You said, that's all. You see, what he really needed, and all that is, wasn't shy to hearing. That's the strength of our defenses. The Chidush HaArim says an incredible thing, unbelievable thing. He says that the halacha is you have to walk at the left hand of your Rebbe. Yes, that's halacha. You're walking with the Rebbe, you have to walk at his left hand side, because the place of honor is the right. In other words, your right hand side is the side of covet, so you give that place of honor, the right hand side, to the Rebbe. So you walk on his left, he should be on your right. That's how you walk. So Chidush HaArim says, beautiful, beautiful idea. He says, what does it mean that you walk at the Rebbe's left? He says that the right-hand side means chesed. The right-hand side of the Rebbe is the side of approval, of warmth, of approval, where the Rebbe says you're doing well. Left-hand side of the Rebbe is the side of gevurah, where he smacks you, and he punches you down, and tells you how stupid you are. But he says, it says over there in Chazal, that a person who walks on the right of his Rebbe is a bull. It means he'll never mount to anything, an empty individual. The shali is, you walk at your Rebbe's right-hand side, you'll never mount to anything because you don't know this detail of halacha. This derech eretz. No, it's not that bad. The reason you'll never mount to anything is because if you walk at the Rebbe's right, means you always want to be on the side of your Rebbe when he's always telling you how well you're doing. Yes? So then you'll never mount to anything. If you better walk on his left, they're going to punch you down. So then you'll amount to something. I once heard my Rebbe say that his Rebbeim, he said he used to hear insults. He used to hear insults from them. They used to tell him how downright ridiculous he was 100 times before he heard one compliment. I can't imagine anybody telling him that he did anything ridiculous, but that's what he said 100 times. He wouldn't exaggerate before one compliment. That kind of thing could maybe bash in a little bit of das. Genuine Torah learning, genuine relinquishing of your own vested interest, genuine acceptance of somebody who has got some degree of das. But no matter how great the Rebbe and how great the effort, you have to do it yourself. And no matter how much he tells you, he can't tell you your own inner consciousness. It can't be said. He can teach you the external things. Anybody outside can teach you the mathematical and scientific, but the inner things, the das that you have to absorb, which is what das Torah is that which is a certain kind of inner knowledge that exists completely separate from, or let's say completely, not separate, but not dependent on, independent from, the scientific or empirical wisdom on the outside. But Wasserman used to explain, he used to define Das Torah, which is this Das. He used to say that what Das Torah is when you go to a great man, such a beautiful thing, and it shows you so starkly, he never said it in a critical way, he never would have said it, but shows you so starkly the contrast between us in this generation and what real Das Torah is. He said that real Das Torah is to go to a Rebbe. Listen to this. The reason you go to Das Torah, you go and see a great man, the reason you go is for him to paskin for you, to give you clarity about something that cannot be sorted out intellectually. Again, you do not go to a great man in Torah for him to make the cheshbon more clearly than you can. Yes? An adding machine can do that. You hear that? You don't go to a great man to clarify a halacha where it takes a cheshboning out of the details on this side of the detail, because it doesn't need a great man for that. Anybody who knows halacha, who thinks straight, can figure that out. What you go to a great man for is to ask him things that when you've worked it out to the nth degree, it's exactly 50-50. Exactly 50-50. And he can still tell you what to do. How can he tell you what to do if it's exactly 50-50? That's Das. Das is that which goes beyond that which can be. Isn't that beautiful? So what do you go to a great man for? You go to a great man where two things are 50-50. The marshal, you're working at a certain place, and you have a feeling of loyalty to that place, and you're considering changing your job, but I'll be Torah, you know there's an Indian of loyalty and you want to stay there. On the other hand, your wife wants you to move. But two very strong klalim pulling in two opposite directions, and there's a whole wealth of information you can build up on both sides of the shikur. That's what Das Torah will have to do. And what is this generation to go to Das Torah for? There's people lining up outside Rabbi Yoshi's house for what? For things that any knowledgeable individual could look up in a Mishnah Berurah someplace. Right? But they've got to go ask him. And in some circles they go ask him where they should paint the house. This is what they've asked the Rebbe for. That's not Das Torah. That's exactly the opposite. But the Rebbe can't tell you. What can he tell you? You've got to ask him. He's so exhausted from individuals like that, he'll tell you whether to plant house or not. What can he do? Because Das can't be explained. Can't be explained. It has to be, it has to well up from within. It has to come from within. Das is that faculty by which you know that you exist. The basis of the Das is the fact that you know that you exist. And that's why the Kli, the inner Kli, the inner vessel of the Das is my own grasp of my own existence. The fact that I know I'm here, I do not know because I can figure it out. I do not know it because I can pinch myself. I don't know. Again, the secular Western world thinks the reason that I know that I'm here is because I can pinch myself and then I feel. But that's not the way you know you're here. The reason you know you exist is because you know it. Is that correct? It should, 2 minutes thought should show you that. That even if you couldn't feel and taste and see and hear, you still would know that you are. You still know that you exist. What is that faculty? And of course, that's why explicit secular philosophy has never come up with a formulation, has never come up with a proof for the fact that I exist. It's the oldest problem in philosophy, and it's never been done. There's no formal proof in philosophy, not in scientific, rigorously logical terms, for proof of my own existence. It can't be proved.
Why?
Because it's not amenable to external proof. I think, therefore I am, by the way, does not mean that that's a proof. Think doesn't mean my brain functions. That's no different than my muscles twitching, or my stomach, you know, some other part of the body. It means the statement, I think, therefore I am, really means I know I am, therefore I am. But it's phrased for a person who would understand it, who has his own das. And it's knowledge of one's own existence which can be richly grasped if you're prepared to stop thinking. If you let the external mind function and you keep thinking about am I or am I not, so then you lose it immediately. But as soon as you let that fade and you grasp with richness the concept that you are, so that's the basic clear of the das. This generation, of course, gets stuck in. So a university lecturer was teaching his philosophy class. A classic story. He's teaching them that the deepest problem in philosophy is that there's no proof that you exist or not. It's a suffix. There's no formal proof. So one of the students was driven close to psychosis by this. It took him a whole week of grappling with himself. You know, and at the end of a week, he raced back in. No. Very deep story there. And when we see this, and maybe we could finish with this, it needs a whole discussion in its own right, but these are just the seeds of the discussion. Where we see this connected with sukha is that the root of the das is a concept of my own identity. What's called ani. The ani, which in Kabbalah is a whole discussion between the ayin. So understand this carefully. The word ayin, aleph yud nun, is a rearrangement of the ani. The yesh me'ayin that I am now comes from an ayin, comes from an is not that I was a moment ago or a day ago. That ayin gets transformed into the ani that I am now. And tomorrow that gets transformed, that ani gets transformed into the ana of ana Hashem Oshiyano. That same root of the aleph nun, that's what it is. The ani, my own existence, me, who I am, the fact that I'm here, which is the root of my das, the fact that I know it beyond words, and I know it naturally, and it's the basis of my wisdom and my inner knowledge. That's the ani. There's a gon someplace that says, if I'm not mistaken, it's a gon that says oniya, the Hebrew word for a ship. Beautiful, beautiful idea. You want to connect it to yona. The word for oniya, which means a ship, the root of that word is ani. Because he says, the eye of my personality is what carries the neshama over the sea of this world. Yes? It carries what floats you in the world and stops you from sinking, right? In the water that meshes and batters out your shape. What floats you over that dangerous, uncharted sea that has no paths in it. That's the vessel of the das, of the ani dimension. Kabbalah says that the grasp of your own existence is a flash, it's an explosion of consciousness. Ayin is nothingness, and ani is me, and ana is where I'm going. Ana means an expression of longing so deep that there's no translation. In English translation of please is a pathetic translation. There's really no translation for ana Hashem. And if you think about it in Hebrew, when you say may ayin bata, remarkable thing, where do you come from? Ba'ana teilech, la'an, ana teilech, where did you come from, where are you going? It's a simple Hebrew, common everyday Hebrew, Russian Kodesh, the way you speak. Somebody walks out of that room and he's walking out there. And the way you speak to him, you say, "Me ayin bata, where did you come from? Vel ana teilech, where are you going?" The words mean, you come from nothingness. Me ayin bata, you come from nothingness. And ana teilech, you're going to an ana, you're going to a dimension of longing that can't even be translated. In between the two of those is the ani that you are. Unbelievable. It means the way we grasp our existence is the explosion of a me that came out of an ayin a moment ago. Yes? That exploded into existence now, and that's going to be dissolved into an explosion of a new existence a minute from now, tomorrow morning, a day from now, that bears no, the proportions are inexpressible. And that's what it means when the Gemara says, if you look in the Gemara that talks about many of these things that we mentioned this evening, the Gemara says that when Hillel came to the Beis HaMikdash, on this night, during these nights of Sukkot, he used to walk into the Beis HaMikdash. And he used to say, Imani kan, akol kan. If I'm here, everybody's here. Imani kan, and if I'm not here, who's here? You know, the epitome of anava, of absolute self-effacing modesty. He used to walk in and say, if I'm here, everybody's here. And if I'm not here, no one's here. So the superficial ears of this generation hear unadulterated pride. Yeah, he walks into the party, lahavdil, elif, havdolis. I'm here, boys. The cheapness of this generation. Anybody from this generation reads that Gemara. But in Kabbalah it says that the word Ani means Hashem. It's the name of Hashem. It's the name of Hashem. It's one of the names of Hashem. It comes out of the three psukim of 72 letters. Ani is the name of Hashem. When Hillel walked in, he said, Imani kan, akolka, meaning the real Ani of the world. The thing about Hillel was he was at a madrega of such a nova that he could be identified with that Ani as a madrega. But for our level this evening, what it means is that the grasp of my own eye, the Ani that I am, the ship that carries me through this world, the eye that I am, that's the root name of Hashem's name. Meaning, in terms of this evening's conversation, you want to reach some of the degree of the Emunah of the Sukkah on this last night that we spent in the Sukkah. You want to reach some of that dimension of the Tzeilah de Emunah, the shadow of faith, the shadow of Emunah. So the way it has to be done is that the grasp of my own existence has to be the Kli that begins to grasp an existence outside of myself. And it's a pathway that's got nothing to do with intellectual. Nothing to do with intellectual. It has to be a grasp that starts with my own rich awareness of who I am. What does it mean that I'm here? What does it mean that I'm human? At least human. And beyond that, what does it mean that I'm not a goy? That's what Sukkos is. And then you can move into Shmini Atzeres. Shmini Atzeres, you move in, you leave the goyim behind. You move into a private zone where you're higher than that. Different than that. But it's a zone that has to be where the Sukkah is. It has to be a zone where it's grasped in a level much deeper than what you can put together intellectually. Not a place for a neat vault. If we can do that in Mitzvah Shem, so then we'll have some of the message of the Arova. Taking that Arova that has nothing of it, nothing intellectual, there's nothing in action, all it has is the rock bottom inner consciousness, the common sense inner consciousness of what it means to be around, to be human, to be Jewish. That means Shaloya Saningoi, that kind of Jew has that. That kind of Jew has a deep, deep awareness that Torah is a Meirosha. It does not say the Morosha of Yana, it doesn't say that, it says Morosha of Kilas Yaakov. Am Haaretz knows that. That has to be awakened. The way to awaken that has to be Torah. It has to be Torah without the ego interfering. It has to be Torah without the lower self interfering. Without all those vested interests and all that superficiality and all those defenses, they have to be given up. Person has to be willing to take the left hand of the Rebbe. Person has to be willing to take Torah and hear it as it is, to forego all the superficiality, and to hear what Torah is saying, whether it's easy to take, whether it's hard to take. Mitzvah Hashem, if we could get that clear, we'd be able to feel a little bit of the shadow of Emunah and enter Mitzvah Hashem Shana Rabbah in such a way that the din should be sealed finally, in such a way that we can enter a real simple stuff.